Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. What a great show we have for you. I'm a little nervous, frankly, because I have to talk to really smart people today, and I always get really nervous when I have to talk to smart people. Second hour, Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, will be here. And I believe we will just do open forum with Mark. You can ask Mark whatever you want. It's always nice when Mark is on. And we have an author published by Ignatius Press, the first hour, and a conversation, frankly, I've been looking forward to. The book is called Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. It's from the Augustine Institute and Ignatius Press. And it's part of a series, What Every Catholic Should Know, that Ignatius Press has done. And it's a whole bunch of just wonderful books on various topics that Catholics should know. This one is by Bronwyn McShay, and that's what we're going to talk about today, is women in the church, or women of the church, I suppose I should say. You're welcome to call if you want to get in on the conversation, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. In addition to this book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know, Bronwyn McShay is also the author of, La Duchesse. How'd I do on that, Bronwyn?
Good. Pretty good. Okay. La Duchesse, yes.
Okay. La Duchesse. All right. And then also, in addition to that, the author of Apostles of Empire, Bronwyn McShay, thank you very much for being here with us.
My pleasure, Cy. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're also teaching now. You've taught in various places, but you're teaching now at the Augustine Institute. You're a visiting professor there. Is that right?
Yes. So I teach mostly remotely, but I go on campus once in a while. So I'm based in New York, not Denver.
A lot of my college professors taught remotely, but they were in the class with us. They just taught remotely. Does that make any sense? I don't think that makes any sense. The number is 888-318-7884. I always like to start out with the hard-hitting questions. So why'd you write this book? Why'd you write Women of the Church?
Well, it grew out of two sources. So my second book, La Duchesse, which you mentioned, it's a biography of a French Catholic duchess named Marie de Vignerot. She was the niece of Cardinal Richelieu. And I kind of stumbled across her as a patroness of the Jesuit missions in New France when I was doing my first book. And I just started keeping a file on her. And I realized she was one of the most prominent Catholic leaders of the 17th century, and no one had ever heard of her. And the Pope knew her at the time. Everyone in Europe thought she was a very important leading Catholic figure.
But forgotten.
Because she was a duchess, she's forgotten for various reasons that I get into. And so that project, I wrote her biography, which took many years, but it was very rewarding. It got me more into the subject of the history of Catholic women generally. And so when I was asked to teach at the Augustine Institute several years ago, one of the teaching ideas that we had at the beginning was a course on the history of women in the church. And so the lectures for that course partly inspired this book idea. Once I was at the Augustine Institute, this book project kind of developed with them. So it grew out of these two sources, I would say.
And
my research.
Apostles of Empire was your first book then?
Mm-hmm.
And when you
yes.
say New yes. France, you mean what we would kind of call Canada now.
Canada, although the French, New France, La Nouvelle France, as they would have said, actually encompassed, theoretically, the whole Great Lakes region. Uh-huh. And then eventually the Mississippi Valley, which then sort of splintered into, they broke into another province. So New France actually was more than just Canada. It was parts of what became the United States. And the French had extensive missions, Jesuits and other missionaries. And so that book grew out of my doctoral dissertation at Yale. So,
And that led you to La Duchesse. I'm trying so hard.
La Duchesse, very good.
Because I know you speak French, and it's humiliating to be a Californian trying to say these things, but.
You're doing just fine. I have a family member who was reading the book and said, you know, it's a great book, but there's too many French names in it.
So. that's a problem with French history.
I've often thought there's too many French names in it. I'm used to this sort of thing.
Well, congratulations on the new book, Women of the Church. I think it's a wonderful addition to the series, but also just a wonderful addition to the reading possibilities that parents, I always think, can parents put this in the hands of their kids? Whether they're young kids or teenagers, if you've got a kid who will read, I would love to see this in the hands of a Catholic kid, because in part because maybe there's a balancing effect here. Maybe the story of Christianity is not just Augustine to Aquinas, but there are some female names in there as well.
Sure. And I actually, when I wrote the book, I was envisioning maybe young adults, maybe teenagers. I dedicated the book in part to my young nieces. And one of my younger nieces, who's 9, 10 years old, was actually reading the book this week. So maybe, yeah. Maybe even younger girls than I think, and boys, could read this book. I think I'm hopeful that it will, I say in the introduction of the book, I wish I had known many of these stories when I was growing up Catholic. And so I wrote this in large measure because I wanted people in their earlier years to learn these stories so that you don't have to go to graduate school at Yale and work on several books in order to encounter some of these fascinating, important women in the church's history, which was my trajectory as a Catholic who went to graduate school.
Which was the harder problem for you, finding mm-hmm. women to write about or deciding which women to leave out?
Deciding which to leave out was a challenge because partly this book is one in a series. I believe it has the most, it's the sort of fattest volume in the series. I was given
a strict
word limit. I think so. If it's not the fattest, it's the second widest. So it could only be so long so that it would actually fit well with the series. And so I was given a word cap and of 60,000 words, which was a lot fewer words than I'm used to having writing big biographies and things. And it was tough. Even women that I wish I could have spent several paragraphs on or several pages, I sometimes had to put in a paragraph with one or two other figures because I wanted the book to include many important saints, also blesseds who are less well-known people on their way to possible canonization, but also to kind of reflect the great variety. And so I had to make some tough choices here and there about who to include and how long to include them.
Well, there are important women in the history of the church, just as there are important men in the history of the church who mm-hmm. are not renowned for their sanctity, maybe, but are renowned for some mm-hmm. for their leadership in some other way, queens mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. or leaders of yes. other sorts. Isn't that right?
Yes, and that's one reason I titled this Women of the Church. This is not a typical Lives of the Saints book. Yeah. There are many saints, very saintly figures throughout. But I'm a historian. I was asked to write this as a historian for a series called What Every Catholic Should Know. And so I'm thinking, which women in the history of the church should every Catholic know? And I think figures like Isabella of Spain, you know, who started the Spanish Inquisition,
yeah.
or Maria Theresa of Austria, one of the most powerful imperial figures in European history. They were Catholic women. They right. they were a mix of pious and not so saintly sometimes.
Sure.
And so I included figures like that.
Isabella of Spain did start the mm-hmm. Inquisition, but she's also famous for something mm-hmm. else. Like, can we give her credit for one other thing? Like, didn't she send somebody on a trip?
Yes, she was responsible for Christopher Columbus's
okay.
voyages. And also, I get into it a bit. I don't want to, you know, give everything away.
Yeah.
She helped, the church had some kind of moral laxity in the monasteries. So she worked with Cardinal Jimenez de Cisneros. She helped reform some of the monastic institutions in Spain. So she did some good things too.
Bronwyn McShay is our guest. She's a historian, and she's written a lovely book on Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know, part of the What Every Catholic Should Know series from Ignatius Press. And we have Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, on regularly, and I always ask him when he comes on, recommend a book. And he was so enthusiastic last time, holding up this book. And I said to him, I think Bronwyn McShay is the best author's name I've ever heard. You have to be a writer if your name is, that's a writer's name right there, Bronwyn McShay. You were born to it.
I appreciate that. I can't take credit for it because my parents are the ones who decided on this.
Yeah.
It is funny because when I first started writing, I have the problem that some people don't always know if Bronwyn is a female name or male name.
Yes.
So when I was younger, I always used my middle name of Catherine. But Bronwyn Catherine McShay sounded a little too,
Irish?
Don't know. I was a little too long and too self-important. So I like the Yeah, I credit my parents for choosing a good name for me.
Yeah.
So thank
you. Yeah. Well, let me ask you, because in the introduction to the book, you talk about a woman who is a saint, but in addition to being a saint, also an extraordinary leader, which is a different quality than sanctity. Not all saints are great leaders. Not all great leaders are saints, but Claire of Assisi. And several times you use the word ordinary to talk about Claire. What is it about... What is it that drew you to Claire, and what do you mean by that word ordinary?
Right. In the intro, I use the word ordinary specifically in connection to I visited Assisi back in 2015, and I was given a tour of the convent of San Damiano, and I was, you know, brought to the table and the benches where she and her sisters would have meals, and also this kind of stone area where they would do laundry. And I was very, very struck by the ordinariness of the surroundings. I mean, it was a beautiful monastery, one of the most beautiful settings in our Christian, that's out there. But just the kind of the ordinariness of sort of the everyday activities that this saint, that was sort of a giant in my mind, she was one of the few saints I knew about growing up. I'd seen the movie Brother Son Sister Moon that my parents showed me, and so Claire was sort of a kind of larger than life figure in some ways to me. And so to be around where she and her sisters did laundry and ate, and to sit on the same places and walk, it really, the humanity of Claire and her sisters really hit me in Assisi in a way that I don't think would have happened had I not visited there.
Is that kind of the historian's vocation in a way to these people? I mean, there's these people that we know their names, like Claire is one of them. Mm-hmm. Like you, this is just one of the most almost like the name doesn't relate to a person. It just relates to an idea, this, you know, that's bigger than any one person. And so the historian maybe has the vocation of reintroducing us to the person, not just the idea.
Yeah, and I think with in the Catholic world, where we have people who are canonized as saints and honored in special ways, sometimes for many centuries, and so we have all these kind of iconic moments in their life that we emphasize, or ways of talking about them.
Yeah.
In venerating them, that can happen like 10 times over compared to some historical figures with saints. And so part of my job, I feel, as a Catholic who is a historian, is to kind of show saintly figures, and sometimes less saintly, who are important in the history of the church, in kind of real time, in their everyday circumstances, their political context, their social context. So you sort of see, you know, some of the more iconic moments in context, and you realize it's difficult to be a saint. It's never easy to be a saint. And when you see them in their times, I think they become more relatable, even the ones that are very larger than life.
Right. They're not just the painting of the girl getting her hair cut off. Here's a full human being who had to wash her laundry, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Bronwyn.
Yeah, or tell other sisters to do the laundry. or to tell others to do the laundry. Yep, she's an abbess.
That's true. Women of the Church is Bronwyn McShay's latest book, What Every Catholic Should Know. Women of the Church in the What Every Catholic Should Know series from Ignatius Press. It's a heck of a name to live up to if you're a writer, because it sounds like the greatest writer in the world, Bronwyn McShay. Well, she does a pretty good job living up to it. We'll talk more about the book when we come back. You are welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery, and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Thank you so much for all that you do. And your mother, Angelica, and her words, I'll never forget the first shows on television when I found her, and that led me to the radio station.
I'm an 8-year homeschooling mom. I'm a veteran of doing this for a long time. What encouraged me was this beautiful nun named Mother Angelica, and one day she said, well, if you don't like the school, why don't you just pull them out and homeschool them?
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Did you know everything in our online store at shop.catholic.com is on sale? Books, digital products, online courses, gift items, and more. We've got it. We've even got Bronwyn McShay's new book, Women of the Church, in there. You can go there and buy that right now. Hundreds of items on sale at shop.catholic.com. Hundreds of items, including Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know from Ignatius Press, written by our guest, Bronwyn McShay. Thank you again for being here with us. I appreciate that. And delighted to get to talk about Women of the Church. And I'm going to let me just throw this out there. I think there is a prejudice against the Catholic faith sometimes that it's anti-woman or that it's detrimental to women. Can you just talk a little bit about what you think about that idea and go ahead.
I would say one reason a lot of the stories I didn't know in this book was because some of the, like earlier on in my education, I went to public schools and secular institutions for my education. So early on, many of the accounts of the history of women in Western civilization or European countries or in Catholic world, as we might be more interested in, really painted pictures of conflict between men and women, maybe nuns getting sort of never being able to do what they really want to. So that there's sort of strains in certain lines of scholarship in women's history with sort of a feminist bent of certain kinds that like to underscore conflict between men and women, at least traditionally. And so stories of collaboration. I dealt with this issue even in my first book, looking at the Jesuits in New France, because some of the scholarship on the missionaries, whenever it came to Native American women or the French, some of the French women who came over to New France, were some of the existing scholarship underscored conflict between the missionaries and women, whether French or indigenous. And when I was looking at the sources, I just found so many examples also. I mean, there are examples of conflict, but there's many examples of collaboration with Catholic nuns, with Native American women who converted to Catholicism and were assisting with the mission and were kind of partners with the missionaries, not just being told what to do or in conflict with them. And so this whole issue of both women's collaboration in a positive sense with the clergy and the laity more broadly, their collaboration with the clergy in mission settings was one of the topics that I wanted to contribute to in a scholarly way. And that theme has sort of carried through my other work. And so, I just think it's just hard to, a lot, there's sort of broad brushstroke caricatures of the Catholic Church when it comes to women.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, even some of our church leaders kind of echo that in trying to make up for what they perceive to be the world's criticism of the church. And so we sometimes accidentally reinforce that own perception of our own history while trying to correct it. And so with this book, I show plenty of examples of conflict and difficulties various saintly women had, sometimes coming from churchmen. But there are numerous examples also of people working together and the complementarity of men and women and laity and clergy as well. And and friendships between male and female saints and all that. So,
it does sound like the history is full, and Catholic history therefore is full of injustices towards women, abuse of women, all of that. But and so we don't want to pretend like that's not there, that's not in the history.
Right.
But there's another narrative that's also there, And it's a story of great women doing great things because of their relationship with Jesus Christ. Like, this is at the center of what you write. I mean, I again and again see that it's the person of Jesus who's making the primary difference here in the lives of the men and women you're talking about in this book.
Yeah, I think there are certainly cases where, I mean, one of the most famous would be Saint Teresa of Avila. She begins to have mystical visions and encounters with Christ, encouraging her reform of the Carmelites. And she met some real resistance among some Catholic leaders in Spain. She eventually gets a lot of assistance from some churchmen and the King of Spain in particular, and the Carmelite authorities in Rome as opposed to Spain. So she does find friends to assist her, but it's really, there are many moments of conflict in her life. Her writings were suppressed in her lifetime. And yeah. I think it's her fundamental relationship with Christ that she encounters some of the time in this mystical relationship that is really the key to understanding her moments of courage and leadership, despite a lot of challenges that she's dealing with, including sometimes poor health. And so, I think the mystics show this very strongly, but it's at work in other people's lives as well.
Is it at work in the history of the church? So when you look at the kind of the I don't know if history has progress. I don't want to get into that debate. I don't know, but you see the process anyways of, you know, the church moving through time. The Christ himself is a radical departure in his relationship with women from and in his teaching about men and women. Does the church immediately just live up to all the promise in Christ's teaching as far as that goes? Or is this an unfolding thing over time?
I would say no, it doesn't immediately live up to it. I think I draw from the work of some other scholars in sort of painting pictures of this. I have footnotes, you know, for different parts of the book where I'm not an expert. And the early church is one area where I'm not, that's not where my training is. But I think certainly when it came to Christ's interactions with some women that caused scandal among sometimes even his own disciples, and then also the Christian view of marriage as a coming together of two equal parties consenting, this was highly radical.
Yes.
And this develops in early Christian writing. And also the idea connected to that, and I'm drawing from other scholars for this. There was actually, people might think, because some of the critique that modern feminism has against Christianity is that it burdens women with this idea of purity too much in a way it doesn't burden men with. But ironically, in the ancient world, more people in some ways thought it was more possible for men to live a kind of monastic virginal existence than women. They thought women were sort of more animalistic and more incapable of maybe consecrating virginity in a way. I mean, there were certainly Vestal virgins and things like that, but the bias was actually against women kind of offering themselves as sort of pure offerings as virgins. And so that also brings in a kind of radical egalitarian idea that both men and women are either called to marriage or to some sort of more radical existence with purity at the heart of that. And so it takes a long time. And some of the very church fathers who promote some of these ideas in ways that are kind of radical for their time sometimes also will say things about women that don't sound too great if you're a woman reading them. But so it's sort of a question of, you know, Christ reveals difficult truths of all kinds, and the church's story in history is the story of people trying to follow Christ, not always succeeding,
right,
and trying to
right
collectively more and more kind of honor the teachings that are given by Christ to the apostles.
Well, wouldn't you, probably some of the hardest things to remove are the assumptions that we have that are often that we accept uncritically. And so you have, it seems almost like what I get reading Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know, your new book, you see beautiful friendships between men and women, even in the ancient church. You see these really important women like the early martyrs, certainly like the mother of Jesus herself. But you also see it's taking a while, it's centuries, for it to fully challenge the assumptions that everybody has about what a man is, about what a woman is, about how we're supposed right. to relate to one another.
Right, it does. And there's kind of history is not that linear. It goes up and down, and there's problems. And what, to me, as an early modern historian, one of the things that most fascinates me is the revolutionary moment in France and other countries. Before the revolutionary period, before there's sort of democracy spreading around the world, there was room for certain powerful women if they came from certain aristocratic families. There was some marriage laws that were in favor of women having property if it came from their paternal families. After the revolutionary period, when democracy starts kind of coming everywhere, there's actually this strong movement in favor of men dominating women.
Whoa.
In the 19th century.
What an interesting thing. All right, Bronwyn Miché here to tell us how democracy ruined everything. We'll get back to that. That's not really it. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today.
Conversation about God's truth along with guests and your calls. I'm Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, and I invite you to join me tomorrow for Beacon of Truth on most of these EWTN stations. Now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about the new book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know, from Bronwyn Miché. It's published by the Augustine Institute, where Dr. Miché is visiting, is that right? Visiting professor, yep, and by Ignatius Press. And a wonderful book, I feel like you could put this in, I don't know why this is my bias, because anybody could read this and profit from it, but I feel like you could put this in the hands of a young person and it will be formative for them. They will see possibilities for what it means to be Catholic that they didn't see before.
I mean, I'm hopeful that's the case. The sort of verdict's out, you know, what age can read the book and sort of grasp it. But I think there's such a variety of stories, religious vocations, different vocations that, I'm hopeful that will be the case, whether, you know, parents reading the book and teaching their kids about some of the stories or kids reading it directly. I hope so.
But I get what you see. You and I might have two different ideas about young people. For me, anybody under 30 is a young person. So that's what I was talking about.
I was thinking of my nieces.
I wasn't talking about 8 year olds, but there are those precocious 8 year olds. But one of the things I liked, and I take the warning not to romanticize the past to heart. Mm-hmm. But I liked the stories of, especially in the ancient world of. Of men and women who were friends in the church. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Christianity affords an ability or gives an opportunity for friendship between men and women that is very hard to have separated from Christianity. And I was thinking about, I'm thinking about as I say that, St. Jerome, who is mostly known as the most irascible saint ever. Like he's known for being in a constant bad mood. That's what people know him for. But these holy women are his close friends who he relies upon and also I think it's Marcella is the how you would pronounce the name. How she's so brilliant that if he actually told the truth about how brilliant she was, other men wouldn't believe him. You know, it's a beautiful thing, these kinds of holy friendships.
Yeah, and some of my own friends are irascible sometimes. So
you should work here at Catholic Answers.
I always appreciated Jerome. I always appreciated Saint Jerome, a sort of curmudgeon saint. But yes, Marcella of Rome, Marcella actually is how you pronounce it. He said that she was she knew the scriptures better than almost anyone. And when he would travel, he would encourage, you know, if you have a question, ask her. You know, in my absence, how to interpret. This or that teaching, you know, and so there are various examples like this in the early church and later on of important holy friendships. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the modern women. And again, modern, I mean, sometimes we think modern is anything that came after Kanye, but I mean modern in the sense of the last 500 years, you know, anything that came since the Reformation. What has the role of women been in this very turbulent half millennium for the Catholic Church?
Well, there are maybe two general strains I would point to. I mean, I speak to more than that in the book, both during the Reformation period, also during the Revolutionary period, when there were attacks on ecclesiastical institutions, monasteries, convents, Catholic women, whether nuns in convents or even sometimes ordinary Catholic lay women, really showed a lot of courage in these moments in Reformation England, for example, or in Revolutionary France, kind of standing up against the authorities, hiding priests, making sure mass took place in their homes, and sometimes facing the law and in a few cases being martyred for their courage. And in the case of the French Revolution, and I'm drawing from other scholars who've worked on this more closely than I have, the Reign of Terror period in the French Revolution is seen as partly coming to an end because the resistance of Catholic, ordinary Catholic people around France, including women, was so strong to some of the anti-Christian activity going on that it sort of helped put the brakes on the most radical aspects of the French Revolution. Yeah. So, and then the second thing, it actually really hit me. I mean, I had a strong appreciation for this going into this book, but it really hit me writing the narrative, how crucial Catholic women, especially consecrated women in the 19th century were to building up schools for poor students, boys and girls, hospitals for people who couldn't necessarily afford the best medical care, various ministries to the poor, you know, places to provide young working class women or children with kind of safe places to be and to learn some skills, you know, in a time when families are breaking apart due to migration because of the Industrial Revolution, the social charitable infrastructure that we associate more and more in modern times with the government, women actually, Catholic women were tremendously important to building up institutions, often without much government support in the 19th century. And the legacy of that it's just staggering when you see it in the history. And so I gained a new appreciation of the history of consecrated women, like a more of an appreciation than I even had before I wrote this book.
That's an extraordinary point, because it's so often if you hear that, well, tell us about the history of the Catholic Church in the 19th century. Well, you're going to get, Pope Pius, the various Pope Piuses and Pope Leo and all that. Mm-hmm. But it's thousands and thousands of women founding churches and hospitals is probably the primary work of the Catholic Church in the 19th century.
Yeah, and men too. The proportion of religious actually went in favor of women in the 19th century for the first time in history. It was like, I think something like 60-40 women to men. So it was another historian I quote, Dharmad McCullough, said at some point that it's like the face of the church became more feminine because of this new balance, the gender balance of religious who are out in the streets or out in hospitals. And so there are stories of collaboration too and partnerships that I show, but the 19th century was really a time when Catholic women came into their own in certain new ways, partly because of changes in education of women, formal schooling for girls. This starts to translate into different types of activities within the church and beyond.
Are there any of these 19th century women that you felt yourself particularly drawn to that you thought, wow, she's really something? I guess you have to tell each of their stories. Is there one whose story you just particularly got caught up in yourself?
I there were so many of them that I cared about. There's several different people. Mother Mary Lang. There were African American consecrated women in the young United States that faced difficulty, like discrimination, even from Catholic religious orders they wanted to be part of. So there were some pioneering African American religious women that really hit me at learning their stories and just integrating that into the narrative. And so they stand out.
Were they orders of African American women, or were they orders of women?
There were several, and I'm blanking on the names because I don't want to get things wrong in the middle of the interview. But there were new institutes that were started by African American women, sometimes because they were not permitted to join existing congregations. And so,
there's a historian. Extraordinary thing, though, to in a certain sense be rejected by the church, because there was certainly a segregation in the United States, not necessarily everywhere in the church, but in the 19th century in the United States, African American Catholic is at a disadvantage twice, inside the church and outside the church. And here's women founding orders to take care of orphans or to teach children or found a hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a scholar I cite for some of the material that I integrated, Shannon D. Williams. She's written about this much more extensively. So they stand out to me. Some of the early the women involved in founding missionary organizations, like Saint Emilie de Villar, she lived in the early 19th century. She was French. She just decided to found a missionary congregation that would go to North Africa and parts of the Ottoman Empire, and they were opening hospitals and ministries in North Africa at a time when women were not doing mission work very very much yet.
They were blazing the trail.
Do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so people like Mother Cabrini kind of have examples like this before them when she begins her congregation too. So
we're talking about women of the church. If you've got questions about that, whether you're Catholic or not, you are welcome to call with your question. Bronwyn McShay is our guest. Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know is the book. It's out now from the Ignatius Press. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about the 20th century. 888-318-7884.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul Street Evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Each weekday, we'll dive into the timeless teachings of our Catholic faith, drawing upon the wisdom of the ages to navigate the challenges of today. Together, we'll seek truth, find inspiration, and forge a deeper connection with God. I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, and I invite you to join me for Beacon of Truth, tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about women of the church. You are welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884. I got so caught up in the conversation, I forgot to give out the phone number for like 15 minutes there. I apologize for that, but I can see the lines are all filling up now. I apologize. I didn't give out the number for a little bit. Some of the American women that we know the names of, but maybe they, mm-hmm. like Catherine Drexel, for example. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Catherine Drexel. Maybe people don't know about her anymore.
Yeah, she was a Philadelphia heiress from a very wealthy family. She and her two sisters inherited a lot of money from their father, and she established a new congregation that was dedicated to the education of Black children and Native American children. And this was not something that girls from elite families in Philadelphia were supposed to be doing.
Really?
So this was kind of a radical decision. So, and she was apparently, partly because she was so rich, she was seen as one of the most eligible bachelorettes on the marriage market, and she decided to become a nun and do this instead. And so her legacy is rather dramatic in that regard. So eventually starting institutions all over the country.
And what do you make of that? I mean, even into the ancient world, but mostly, I guess, if I'm reading the book right, mostly starting in the medieval period, women lead institutions within the Catholic Church. They lead mm-hmm. giant monasteries or movements mm-hmm. or institutes or hospitals or all that starting in the medieval period. Maybe that's a story people don't know.
Yeah, I think some of the early abbesses, I mean, their powers change as you get later in the Middle Ages, but some of the early abbesses had similar territorial governance powers that some bishops had in terms of they would actually be in charge of several communities, sometimes male communities under their authority. So in medieval period, it's kind of a patchwork. Bishops didn't govern all institutions in their territory. Sometimes abbots and abbesses did as well alongside them.
Certainly during the World Wars, maybe I'll just leave it to you to say what you'd like to say about mm-hmm. Edith Stein. But, I'll just leave that. I mean, she, a Jewish woman, a convert to the Catholic mm-hmm. faith, a Carmelite, one of the world's great philosophers, and mm-hmm. murdered by the Nazis.
Yeah, and she was all, in some ways, even before all that happened, she was one of the first women to get a doctorate in philosophy in her setting. So she was kind of a bit of a trailblazer during a time when more women were going into higher education. She's a obviously remarkable figure. Not everyone knows her sister, Rose, also died with her at Auschwitz and was also a convert. So,
Are they killed because they're Jewish? Are they killed because they're nuns?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Are they what brings yes. Edith Stein and her sister Rose to be killed by the Nazis?
They were taken because they were Jewish, and the Carmelites knew she was moved to the Netherlands to try to protect her because of her Jewish ancestry during her life, and then when the Nazis had more control in the Netherlands, she gets taken away, and it's very quick between the day she's taken and the day she's killed. It's truly terrible. So
And then in Poland, I guess about the same time, Faustina Kowalska. I mean, God just doesn't stop, does he? He just keeps calling extraordinary women in her lifetime, you wouldn't say this is one of the most important people in history, but now we've got Divine Mercy Sunday. We just, you know, she's one of the most important figures in the modern Catholic Church.
Right. And she emerges in this context where some of the most, world altering activities are happening, kind of the scene of on the eve of World War II. So I present her in the context of this dramatically changing world that the world wars are part of. And it was initially a challenge to me. How do I write about some of the great saints that stayed in monasteries, like most of their convents, most of their lives, and are not out there? Because I'm a historian, I like seeing people moving around and doing things more actively.
Have a
right?
war. Overthrow a government. But makes it easier on the historians.
When I actually got caught up in the details of her life, she's a fascinating figure, how she even became a nun and all that. So the challenge ended up being to, keep the part about Faustina to the right number of paragraphs and not write too long about her. So we're talking
about the women of the church by the author of Women of the Church, or with the author of Women of the Church, Bronwyn McShay. We'll go to the phones. We'll give you a chance to ask your questions. The number is 888-318-7884. We'll start with Walt in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the home of Catherine Drexel. Walt, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Dr. McShay.
That's right. Catherine Drexel is from this area and greatly celebrate her feast day on March 3rd. Great lady. Did you, in your research, find any of these extraordinary women wanting to excise the word man from the Mass or emasculate the Heavenly Father or decide they wanted to be priests?
No, not the ones. No.
I thought you were just going to leave it there. No,
not. I mean, not the ones that interested me and that I felt every Catholic should know. So I did not encounter much of that. So I kind of have a natural bias against people who want to alter the faith as Christ handed it down to us. I think. The question of women's ordination it gets in the way of just looking closely at the tremendous variety of contributions women have given to the church from the beginning. And
I'm going to come back to you, Walt, and let you follow up. But it does put me in the mind of that doesn't mean that these are tame women. It means that they're fully committed Catholic women. But there's rebels in here. There's Dorothy Day in here.
Yeah, there's Dorothy Day. There's also lay women like the Duchess of Aguillon, who I wrote a whole book about, who tell great saints like Vincent de Paul what to do and make their ministries possible because of their connections and some of the great lay women that I present in the book, they're not docile. They sometimes kind of get things happening, and churchmen, including bishops, have to listen to them at times and are told what to do by them. So,
who were scared of Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
I mean, they were, they were nervous around her. Like, what's she going to say?
I would be too. I think she's a remarkable figure.
Walt, you got a follow up or are you good?
No, that was it. I just kind of a snarky question, but it annoys me that there's such an emphasis in modern times that we have to follow the zeitgeist and praise God. The church tradition does not follow the zeitgeist. God bless you.
No, thank you. Thank you, Walt. Thanks very much. The zeitgeist being, I guess, the spirit of the world, and that is the spirit we contend with. But these are also not women who are enemies of the world. I mean, they're not looking for a culture war kind of thing. I don't know how to describe it, but maybe you could describe it. You're the historian, but the through line of it is fidelity to Christ. Is that right?
Yeah, and in some cases, that puts them at odds with, you know, figures in authority in the church who are not honoring Christ as much as they could be, and sometimes it makes them work very fruitfully with male saints and male blesseds and others who are following Christ. So it's not an either or. There's plenty of cases of the same figure dealing with faithful men and unfaithful men in their life that they have to kind of work alongside. And so, yeah. And there's stories also of women being not as faithful as they could be that are disappointing in the end. So, there's more, I guess, we could say about that, but I don't know if there's, you know, another question or another caller.
Thank you, Walt. I want to ask you about this then, though. Are all the women passed on now? They've all that are in the book, or are there any living women that made it into the book?
You know what? I think I tried to restrict it to those who had died, and so
because you never know what the living will do. You know, you might put them in the book, and then they mess up on you, and then you got to go back and take them out.
Yeah, and I also partly because I am a historian, like even writing about the 20th century so confidently is out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do make a comment at the end. You know, some of the women reading this book might be among those women of the church who we remember, you know, down the road. But I tried to kind of limit myself to those whose stories we have records of now.
The book is called Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. It's by our guest, Bronwyn McShay. It's from Augustine Institute and Ignatius Press. You can get it now wherever you are. There is a kind of almost like a camera of history, you know, that these are the things that we pay attention to, whatever falls within this camera shot, you know, that's mm-hmm. what we call history. And whatever's not in that camera shot, we don't know about. Was part of your motivation to move the camera just enough so that we didn't leave women out of the Catholic story?
Yeah, I think sometimes, in very well-meaning ways, sometimes the women's history, the history of women, whether in the church or in other contexts, it often comes across as kind of a side discipline, like another topic of history, as opposed to what I want to do is kind of make sure people know these stories and they actually see the church itself differently. The history of the church is the story of Catholic women in part, right? We're half the church. So,
yes.
And so I think that, you know, obviously church history developed out of the discipline of church history, grew out of theology. And so there's always been a kind of the anchor, the base of sources are theological writings and the decisions by popes and bishops. So that there's very natural reasons why men have had kind of the main spotlight on them. But as the discipline has grown and historians today speak of the history of Catholicism broadly, not just the history of the church institutionally, it's kind of opened up doors to scholars who are not Catholic in many cases, but are just fascinated by the story of Catholicism to kind of show ways in which different actors than were traditionally focused on were very much part of the story. And they help shed new light on some of the main iconic events. You know, you start to look at, say, church councils a little differently, like the call to be missionaries in Vatican II. Mother Teresa and other women missionaries were engaged in some of the very things Vatican II calls for long before Vatican II, and were sort of helped teach the church about what it meant to be a missionary before these statements come out about it by church authorities, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah,
and I do think as you do that, what you just described, it opens up possibilities in the imagination for the person, for the future as well. Like if we forget these women, then we're going to forget that, or maybe we're going to fall for the idea that it's only outside the church that a woman can come to her full potential.
Potential. Yeah. I mean, I go back to what I said in the intro of the book. I was raised Catholic and I never left the church. But there were moments when I was a younger woman that I felt like I didn't have enough role models who were female.
Yeah.
And it's not because they weren't there. It's because the stories that I was told did not include them in the same way. And so I want to help people avoid that same problem that I had to struggle with.
Then they can get the book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. Bronwyn McShay has been our guest. It is her book. You can find her on Twitter or other social media, including, I'm told, the most boring social media, LinkedIn.
LinkedIn. That was, I said that. But and try, Facebook and yeah.
Yeah, try all the usual social media. Dr. McShay, I'm very grateful for the book and that you were gracious enough to take the time to come and talk with us about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, Mark Brumley coming up. We'll do open forum with Mark Brumley. We'll also get his review of Dr. McShay's interview right after this, Catholic Answers Live.